cities. The intellectual core project of the urban age is linking the physical to the social. It's absolutely, that's why we have Anne, Tony, myself, and many architects and urbanists in the wider sense that we're talking about the same subject. And I want to talk about is, in a way, the DNA, Anthony, of the physical fabric of the city. And therefore, if you think of it as DNA, you think of it as a body. How do you intervene in that body? And I think in many ways, there's a sort of good story there. And in one sense, without in any way making a point of difference of being better or worse, the fact that we're not Amsterdam with Berlage, the fact that we're not the mayor of Washington's L'Enfant plan from a historic age, sort of frozen, the fact that we don't have the Cerdà plan of Barcelona, but it's this, is actually quite an interesting situation when we're facing the statistical growth that we're talking about. How do you absorb change there? Well, the great thing is that even, I know this is out of focus, you can't describe London except for one thing, the river, and that's been mentioned before. There's only one thing there and a couple of rather important parts. Every little bit is both different and similar to every other bit. And what we've heard from Anne and Tony is extremely interesting, that a lot of the minorities and poverty are distributed everywhere around London. Some of it is in terraced housing and some of it is in housing estates, but not all of it is in one or all of it is in another. So I think that is important for us. In a way, I'm trying to paint a context for what's going on in the next few days. We're actually looking at four big holes in London, and they're about to change. And they're about to change, Anne, at a pace that is frightening. You're absolutely right. And I think from an architectural and urban design point of view, one needs to understand how you manage that pace and how you build within the grain of the city. Now, London has many Londons. There's this, which is beautiful, it's rich. It doesn't need to be only beautiful and for the rich. And there are interesting reasons. We had a discussion before. What are the planning constraints which stop things like this happening? Well, a lot of them are to do with parking requirements and things like that, where you actually place a car. A lot of them are to do with the management of public space. But this is one London. This is another London. We're very familiar with this. And Anne has already, in a way, painted this picture, as has Tony. But this, you know, this area is going to change dramatically, just as fast as Kennedy Wharf sort of appeared within 7 or 8 years and built a sort of chunk of London, which is now identifiable and has its own DNA, which is part of the success story, whether we like it or not, of the economy of the city. But others get, you know, their socks off. Ian Sinclair tells us that the A13 is beautiful. Well, it is. But because it occupies, it has its own sort of structure of community. And the question I think I want to ask by in this brief presentation is, what is it that we're doing that works or doesn't work with the DNA of London's sort of structure? Anthony made this key point, but it's worth reiterating. We have one rather powerful plan, which Ken has reinforced, which is the Abercrombie 1943 Greenbelt, the great London plan as it was. But on the whole, there are many of you here who are real Londoners, unlike me. London hasn't really had a physical plan. It hasn't had the Cerdà. When Christopher Wren tried it in 1666, I mean, just even before he finished drawing it up, when the whole city burnt, the whole thing was rebuilt exactly as it was. There's always been a resistance to change. And I think, is there a document that I can look at which said that the whole of the South Bank would turn into what it is, with the Tate Modern doing what it did and creating this extraordinary change? Now, there are a few people in this room, Nick Sirota, Fred Manson, who probably are much more responsible for that change, for the good, I would contend, rather than a document written by planners. And that raises an important issue for all of us about how do you manage change with a fabric of this sort. That's the key point. Is there something about London's, let's call it, messiness, which absorbs change if you do it properly? And that was Richard Sennett's key point right at the beginning of this conversation. Can we make better cities as cities grow? Or do we, as we heard from the mayors, increase ghettoization, which is an enormous risk facing us? This is the London plan that Nikki has referred to, and it's an interesting diagram. And I think it's quite interesting that it's just blurry. It's got a lot of purple areas which are where it's going to grow. It doesn't define what that space is going to be like. It's not a master plan in any sort of conventional sense of the word. And some architects get upset about that. Richard Rogers, with whom I work here, feels there should be a much stronger master plan about how the city will grow in the immediate east of Canary Wharf in the area of the Royal Docks. And I think that's probably important to concentrate that. But there's something very powerful about this area that has been referred to, which has its structure. It has a wonderful relationship between the open spaces, the green, and the buildings. And there's this fantastic piece of water. But let's not kid ourselves. The relationship to the Thames in this city is terrible. Where can you actually enjoy that relationship to the waterfront that we saw yesterday in Copenhagen, certainly Amsterdam, and elsewhere? And I think that is a very clear design problem. What I can tell you is that is not the way to do it. And we know, but that's what's happening. And that's what's happened for years. This could be taken anywhere along there. And I think the subtleties that Tony and Anne have talked about, sort of the grain of mix that we've been describing, probably is not possible in an environment of this sort. It's isolated and it's cut off. There's another dimension of London. Some of you have seen this, but it's important to understand issues in the prospect of time. There's London along the river in ancient Roman times, and then it grows, and you suddenly see those little dots around. Well, you know what they are. They're the hamlets of Chiswick, Hampstead, even Chelsea. Because London, 18th century, moving to the early 19th century, sort of the explosion of the Industrial Revolution, and then the predecessors of Peter Hendy came along, and bang, the whole thing explodes with public transport. Behind that are all these dots, all these bits of London which we recognize. They have a name to it, they have an identity. And actually, they're very much like the sort of the Urban Task Force recommendation of having greater density, not 50-story tower blocks alone, but greater density, closer to transport, closer to the sort of social and services that actually sustain the communities that are there. But let's not kid ourselves. It's a big city with lots of different places, and not every one of those communities is identifiable as such. And I think that's an important point to keep in mind. Those are the sort of communities we know. So I want to conclude here in saying, as we could look forward in the next few days into the four areas of analysis, I'm just going to show you an aerial of each of the four areas to place it and to sort of raise the issues. I think it's helpful not only to think of the two predecessors' talks about the growth areas, the statistics, and the fundamental issue of sort of quality of life for people living there, but also where are we in this mess, and how can you deal with it? I mean, one obviously is here, which is the whole Olympics area. I mean, it's interesting that it's a sort of gap in London that you could nearly say you don't know is there. And that's something very, very special about London. The gaps of London are inside the city. They're dispersed elsewhere. Elephant and Castle is another one that we'll be looking at. King's Cross is a third, and then we go west to White City, in fact, this afternoon. So these are sites which have a scale to them, have a density or potential density to them, which I think could either improve London in the future or, frankly, mess up London in the future. When you just think of the scale of White City, which I think is a fascinating project, and we'll hear about that later, it's in West London, it's in an area which is well served by transport, it's well surrounded by wonderful neighborhoods like Notting Hill and the rest of Hammersmith. But just look at the scale in relation to what Canary Wharf is. So the red line shows you what we're talking about, okay? I mean, it's big. And I think, you know, you can handle things in a perhaps more subtle way when it comes to urban integration than Canary Wharf did in a way. And Rem Koolhaas would describe this project. Elephant and Castle equally is another sort of different hole. It's not an empty place. It's a place taken over by ugly pink buildings and by roundabouts. And the one concentration of large housing estates from the 60s and 70s, some of it in need of refurbishment, and big decision taken recently to actually demolish and therefore relocate many of the people there. How do you deal with that? And we'll hear that later. The Olympic site, I think I've already mentioned, and then finally King's Cross becomes a fascinating issue, which leads me to pass on to Peter Hendy in a moment, which is, let's not kid ourselves. This has got more people than Heathrow and Gatwick coming here. It's not on a daily basis with the number of lines. It opens, as Richard was saying today, the gateway literally to continental Europe, with people sort of spewing out in the center of London. Should this be treated, question, as a sort of delicate fabric and the sort of the delicate issues that we've described, I've tried to describe in Pimlico or elsewhere, or could it be a much more sort of cosmopolitan and rough area which deals with the issues and transactions of change? So I want to conclude there by saying that in order to understand London, you also need to understand its physical fabric. Thanks very much.